You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Heroes get remembered.
Here's the windup.
Legends never die.
Fastball hit deep to right.
Welcome to Hardball.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Major League Baseball's history in first person. Conversations that span almost 20 years.
It is 9:46 p.m.
with the men who saw and made that history.
Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch.
Many of whom are no longer with us.
Swung out and missed a perfect game.
Stories from the 1930s. To the 21st century. This is Hardball.
Dad, you want to have a catch?
Welcome to Hardball. My name is Chris Domino, and this is episode 10. First, I want to thank everybody who's found us, and certainly any of you who spread the word a little bit to grow our world. The only way it gets a little bit bigger is if you guys do a little bit of that work, so I greatly appreciate you spreading the word to baseball fans as far and wide as possible. Let's talk about this week. Edward Charles Ford, Slick, the chairman of the board, Whitey. If you have listened to any of the previous 9 episodes, you know that this podcast is not built upon numbers. It's about stories, where players came from, how they made their way to their first major league appearance, the people they met, played with, against, and of course the wins and the losses, and first-person lookbacks years after they did their work and reflections of a baseball life. The goal has always been singular, to make these men comfortable enough to sit back in their chair and open up, separate some fact from fiction, or better yet, tell a story they haven't thought about in years or one that is seeing the light of day for the first time. Mr. Ford did not disappoint on any level. I've had the pleasure to catch up with him a number of times over the years, a quick phone call just to say hello and ask how he is doing. And I always hope against hope that he makes his way to Cooperstown in July as the elder statesman of the game's incredible past. So before we get to Whitey, another Hall of Famer in this series, another one-team Hall of Famer at that, allow me a minute to lay out his greatness. 54 years after he threw his last pitch in an October game, he still holds the record for most wins ever in World Series history. That number is 10. His 236 wins are still the most in franchise history, and this is the Yankees we're talking about. His .690 winning percentage is still the highest of any pitcher in Major League history with over 300 decisions. His .275 lifetime ERA is second only to Clayton Kershaw's .244 from all starting pitchers who started their careers after 1920. By the way, his World Series ERA is actually lower than his regular season number. It's 2.71. He's the only pitcher in World Series history to start Game 1 in 4 straight World Series appearances, and he did it twice. Think about that. Handed the ball to start World Series 8 times. Oh, and the year he didn't? Well, that would be 1960, the year the Yankees lost to the Pittsburgh Pirates and Bill Mazeroski, and all he did was throw 2 complete game shutouts in Game 3 and 6. The decision to bypass Whitey in Game 1 cost Casey Stengel his job. And according to everyone I've ever spoken to who played for the Yankees and some other players I've asked about it, it is singularly the dumbest move any of them have ever seen. With all due respect to all of those men, I've seen something dumber. It was the 33% of Hall of Fame voters who decided in 1973 that Whitey Ford wasn't a first ballot Hall of Famer. Oh, and the 22% who the next year still didn't believe he was worthy in the 1974 vote, the one that just barely got him in. He saw Mickey cry. He talks about throwing to both Yogi and Elston for all those years. We don't get into it, but think about this. He has in his possession the Phil Lynn's harmonica. Yogi thought it was in his museum in Montclair, New Jersey. Now, again, some of you might not know the story, but I promise you, it's worth it. Google it. He played half a season with his boyhood idol, Joe DiMaggio. After the conversation is done, you'll hear an incredible Reggie Jackson story from the mouth of Whitey Ford. It's all here. And quickly, let me go back to two previous episodes. Episode 1 was Stan Musial. We spoke of him being signed as a pitcher and how an arm injury turned him into Stan Musial, one of the greatest hitters of all time. Whitey will tell the story of his Yankee tryout and how that day started him on the road to becoming a Hall of Fame pitcher, Whitey Ford. And in Episode 2 with Phil Rizzuto, I told the story of how long it took to get Phil to come on. He eventually said yes because this man, Whitey Ford, enjoyed our time together enough to tell Phil, do the thing with the Italian guy in Atlanta. You'll enjoy it. And if in summation, you need to know who Whitey Ford was, is, my father was a diehard Brooklyn Dodger fan and did not like the Yankees one bit, but he loved Whitey Ford. Said if that there was one guy who could have changed the fate of the Dodgers postseason history, it was the 5'9", 175-pound lefty who could beat you with his arm, but more importantly, with his tenacity. Here you go. The chairman of the board, Whitey Ford.
When Mick and I played together, we were known to have a beer or two on special occasions.
Like after every game.
It's too bad light beer for Miller wasn't around then.
Yes, less filling because light actually has one-third less calories than their regular beer.
And it really tastes great.
Whitey, if we'd had a great-tasting beer that was less filling in the old days, can you imagine where we'd be now?
Yeah. The Beer Drinkers Hall of Fame.
The big news right now is that Whitey Ford of the New York Yankees has set a World Series pitching record by pitching 30 consecutive scoreless innings. He broke Babe Ruth's record as Babe Ruth had pitched 29 and two-thirds innings.
Mickey's in center field calling the pitches to Yogi. Now for 7 innings, I'm nothing with somebody, not knowing that Mickey Mantle's giving him the signs. In the 8th inning, Mickey got nervous now, nothing. He says, okay, Yogi, I got you this far. You're there on your own. We just lost 4 straight in Chicago and got on the bus, and Yogi was the manager, 64. And Phil Lynn's had just gotten the moniker, and he's back in the back of the bus playing Mary Had a Little Lamb or something. And Yogi hollered back, throw that goddamn thing away. And Phil didn't hear him. And Phil says to Mickey, what did he say? And Mickey says, he says, play louder. He played louder, and Yogi went back and smacked it out of his mouth.
Joining me on Legends of the Game, a gentleman, well, great honor and a pleasure to speak to him. I certainly know a lot of transplants from the New York area are going to be happy to hear. Mr. Whitey Ford joins us this evening, Hall of Famer Whitey Ford. Mr. Ford, how are you today?
Wonderful. Thank you, Chris, for having me on your show.
Well, I appreciate your time today. The pride of Astoria, Queens, I believe, correct?
That's right. I was born in New York City, and when I was a young 5 or 6 years old, we moved over to Queens, Astoria. I grew up in Astoria, Long Island, yes.
And one of the things I always ask for gentlemen, baseball in New York City at that time, 3 teams, who did you find yourself rooting for as a young boy?
Always the Yankees.
Boy, it worked out pretty well then, didn't it?
It sure did. I think I was 10 or 11 years old my first year, and I think it was 1938, so I got a chance to see Lou Gehrig play and DiMaggio, but later on I got to play with him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite a thrill, and there was a lot of arguments in the neighborhood about who was the best team.
Did you have some guys around the block who found themselves being Giant fans and Dodger fans? And
oh, absolutely. It seemed every Friday night, we'd hang out on the corner, and there would be they'd be arguing who was the best center fielder. Was it Pete Reiser with the Dodgers, or Terry Moore with the Giants, or Joe DiMaggio with the Yankees? And each night it was a different argument.
What do you think you gravitated towards the Yankees?
I guess probably just because my father and uncles used to take me there once in a while when mm-hmm. I was young, and probably Joe DiMaggio. He was my first baseball hero.
Did you think, well, let me ask you, at what age did you think the possibility of, if not at Yankee Stadium, the idea of putting on a Major League uniform, when did that pop into your head?
After I was in the big league, in the minor leagues, about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
My first 2 years in the minor leagues, I have to remember I was about 5'9" and weighed about 150 pounds and didn't throw very hard. But then when I got to be about 20 years old, I was in Class A ball in Binghamton in the Eastern League, and I started throwing a little harder. My curveball got a little better, and my control was always good, but that was about the 49 season. That was about the first time I really thought I had a chance to make it to the big leagues.
Now, I must ask, how close did it come to you actually not being a Yankee? I understand there was at least a little bit of a bidding war going on for your services.
Yeah, it really didn't mean anything, though. I was going to sign with the Yankees regardless. They started at bidding at like $3,000 or $4,000, the Giants, and then the Red Sox and the Yankees. And finally, the Yankees said to me, look, we're going to give you $1,000 more than your highest offer, which was $7,000. They were going to give me $7,000, mm-hmm. and I said, that's fine. And I signed the contract, and that was it.
How did you ever think back how things would have been different if you hadn't had an allegiance to the Yankees and maybe the Giants or the Red Sox was the way you went?
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't have had the chance of being, you know, so many World mm-hmm. Series and play with so many great players. Yeah, I've thought about it often. I said, how would I have been able to pitch up in Fenway Park with that short fence?
Right.
But later on, I found out I could have, you know, I've been all right there, too.
Yeah, but you could have actually helped break the curse of the Bambino at some point, perhaps. You and Ted Williams might have actually gotten that World Series ring up in Boston.
Possibly. We came close. I wasn't with the team in 49, but mm-hmm. it went right down to the last day of the season. The Yankees had to win on the last two games of the season against the Red Sox to win the pennant. But outside, we had a lot of close battles with them, and a lot of the Red Sox Yankee games were probably the most exciting to the fans.
Now, a lot of things people might not know is obviously you played high school baseball, but you also played. Did you play for the 34th Avenue Boys Club as well?
Yes, in high school I didn't pitch it. I pitched my senior year. I just pitched a couple of innings, and I still wanted to be a first baseman, and which I played older in high school, and I went to a tryout at Yankee Stadium, and they saw how I hit, so they suggested that I try pitching. And the 34th Avenue Boys, which you just mentioned, was our local Sandlot team, so when I got out of high school, I played with them, and one of our pitchers got hurt, and I started pitching, and our team ended up winning the New York City Sandlot Championship. I think we were, believe it or not, 36-0.
Jeez.
I got a lot of experience pitching then, and my final game was for the championship, and we played at the old Polo Grounds where the Giants played, and we won 1-0 in 11 innings, so the scouts were, you know, a little bit impressed with me anyhow.
Well, I'd imagine that was the beginning of the let him pitch in a big game theory that certainly followed you. Casey Stengel really enjoyed, I've read a lot of things about you and Mickey and Billy, and everybody's talked about that trio of guys and the way you played, but If it wasn't Casey Stengel, do you think you guys would have had the success you had, and do you think it would have been as fun for you?
Oh, yeah, I think. I mean, Casey was a great manager, but we had some great ball players. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what Casey did was very smart. He surrounded himself with three of the best coaches that any team could have. We had Frank Crosetti coaching third, but he also worked with the infielders on their fielding. He had Bill Dickey coaching first, who, you know, worked with the hitting. He helped Yogi become a good catcher. And then Jim Turner, our pitching coach, was just great. So they more or less handled the team. You know, Casey, they picked the players who were going to play. But, mm-hmm. you know, Casey was the one, somebody was going to steal. He'd give the sign for that, or bunting and things like that. And he also got along very well with the press.
And he needed the personality he had to probably handle some of the things that you guys were up to, correct?
Exactly. Yes, he did.
Now, what does Whiskey Slick mean?
I'm not really sure how it ever came about, but Casey said something to that effect that we were Whiskey Slick, and Mickey, for some reason, I only thought that we drank a little bit, which was right, but we picked our spots, and mm-hmm. It was a little overrated. God, Mickey never would have been played more games than anybody in the history of the Yankees if. All the stories you read about him were true, about being out at night, and the same with myself or Billy Martin. But I think Casey came up with that expression, Whiskey Slick, and I'm not really sure what it meant.
Well, it's one of the great nicknames. I mean, the chairman of the board is fantastic, but Slick is also.
Well, Mickey called me Slick right till we lost him, but quite a few guys call me that now, and especially, you know, ex-Yankees.
Mr. Ford, do you remember the first time you put on a Yankee uniform in the big league?
Yes, very well. I was in Kansas City in 1950, and we'd just taken a long train ride from Minneapolis to Kansas City to start a homestay. And I was awoken about 5:30 in the morning by Park Carroll, our general manager, and said, the Yankees just called and want you to get to Boston as soon as possible. And I didn't go to, I got right up, and they finally got me on a plane, and I flew to, actually to New York, and then took a train up to Boston, and that was my first day. I think it was like July 1st, 1950, and my first game wasn't a very, I went in the bullpen, I guess they wanted me to get a few winnings, and the very first game, Tommy Byrne, that I was with them, Tommy Byrne had started, and after about four innings, we were losing about 8-0, and they just put me in to get a little experience, and the Red Sox just banged me all over the ballpark. I think the score ended up being like 17-4 or something like that. And what had happened was the first base coach for the Red Sox knew every pitch I was throwing after I threw about a half a dozen pitches. And Tommy Henrik, the first baseman at the time, came over and said to me, he says, he called me Eddie at the time. That was my Ed. He says, Eddie, this is the first base coach. He is calling all the pitches. And I had no idea why. But anyhow, the next day, Jim Turner and Eddie Lopat got a hold of me. We went down to bullpen, and they found out right away what it was. I was turning my wrist, especially in a stretch. I'd turn my wrist when I was going to throw a curve, and I'd keep my wrist flat against my stomach when I was going to throw a fastball. And it was quite easy to pick up, so we straightened that out right away.
Welcome to the big leagues.
Welcome to the big leagues. And
I guess they weren't figuring out that stuff when you pitched for the 34th Avenue Boys Club.
No, or even in the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. You know, in minor leagues, you had usually a player coaching first base, and the manager would coach third. There was no such thing as pitching coaches or regular coaches, so I had no problem in the minor leagues. But it was something that was really, it was corrected real easily. And
obviously, you went 9-1 the rest of that season.
Yes, yeah, I won my first 9 games, and I felt bad. The one loss, I mean, it was my loss, but I blew a save for Eddie Lopat in the 9th inning in Philadelphia. It was 3-2, and somebody hit a home run off of me with a man on, and that was my first loss. But I felt worse about losing the game for Eddie Lopat, who, was one of the veteran pitchers with the team.
Did you find yourself in 1950 a little bit pinching yourself at night, saying, boy, this is going real well, and this is everything I hoped it would be?
I mean, we still lived in Astoria at the time, and, all my buddies that I played Sandlot Bowl with were coming to the games, and, I really got a kick out of it. And I think we had 70, we counted 73 of my friends that I grew up with, went to the World Series game in 1950 that I pitched.
And that was the clinching game, was it not, 1950?
That was the final game against the Philadelphia Phillies, yes.
I mean, it's really amazing. You think about it, your first year in the majors, not only are you playing with the Yankee team that's got Joe DiMaggio, Mickey would come next year, I know that, but you're looking around and you're pitching a deciding game in a World Series, and a lot of guys don't get that opportunity for entire careers, and then some.
Well, I wouldn't. We won 4 straight, so it really wasn't that much pressure on me. But I really wasn't. I never was nervous going out to pitch. About an hour before the game, I'd be a little itchy to get out there and get the game started. But once I got out the mound, I was pretty relaxed and did exactly what I wanted to do.
I'd have to ask you about 1961. You go 25-4, you win the Cy Young, you win 2 World Series games, and certainly what's most memorable is the home run race that year. How much, it's 40-plus years now, but etched in your memory? I mean, do you remember details about that season in terms of what Mickey and Roger were doing?
Oh, yeah, and then that movie came out, 61, which reminded me a lot more, but it was a great season. I kind of liked it because the press, ordinarily, if I was having that kind of year and there's nothing else going on with the team, like there was no home run race, the press would have been after me a lot with interviews and meeting after every game. But with Roger and Mickey, fighting for that home run thing, the press sort of left me alone, and it was kind of nice. I enjoyed it.
Ralph Houck did something a little different that year. Didn't you pitch more that year in terms of starts and actual games that you went out there?
Right. I met Ralph. He'd just become manager. I met him at Madison Square Garden at a basketball game, and he asked me then, he said, how'd you like to try and pitch every fourth game? And I said, I'd love it, because I really didn't like sitting in the dugout watching games all the time if I wasn't involved in them. And we tried it, and Johnny Sain had come over as our new pitching coach, and he had done it quite a bit with Warren Spahn, and remember Spahn, Sain, and the Day of Rain and things like that.
Well, what Lou Burdette once told me? The Spahn and Sain and Pray for Rain, Lou Burdette's was, what did he say? Spahn and Burdett, better yet. Because Lou thought, and Lou was a heck of a pitcher.
Oh, he's great. In fact, he was my roommate at Kansas City when I got called up.
Well, he had one of the great World Series all times for a pitcher.
Oh,
in 57, yeah, I guess it was.
1967, right. He won three games,
right.
And he was unhittable. I was sorry that we lost him in the trade.
Yeah.
Especially when he had been my roommate in the minor league.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
One of the other things, too, you mentioned the movie 61. Pretty accurate in terms of what was going on. I mean, could you sense, I spoke to Mrs. Mantle yesterday, and she really does believe that in 61, Yankee fans embraced Mickey like never before because he was the homegrown guy. And it's amazing. He won a Triple Crown in 56. He was an MVP a couple of times. But it almost took that home run race to have
right.
Yankee fans look up and say, holy cow, this guy is one of us, and
yeah,
he's pretty good.
They did, and the fans got on Roger a little bit, but I think the movie overplayed it mm-hmm. quite a bit. The fans weren't, I mean, they were, you know, on him once in a while, but it was nothing compared to what the movies, you know, made it out to be. And then when he got closer to the record, I think the fans were really pulling for, you know, they'd rather have had Mickey do it.
But right.
When they saw Mickey got hurt at the end of the year, I think they really went along with Roger, and they really liked him.
Well, thank God it was a Yankee is probably what they ended up thinking.
Exactly.
Instead of an Oriole or somebody else, or Ted Williams doing this to him.
Right.
We mentioned Billy Martin before. True or false, did he hit a home run off you after he was traded and you were pitching against him for the first time?
Yeah, he was traded to Kansas City, and we had a big lead, and I didn't do this. It's about the only time I ever done it. We went in like 8-1 or something like that in the stadium, and I threw a big slow curve to him, and he took it for it, and I just hollered in the same thing. In other words, I was going to throw the same pitch again, and he believed me, and he hit it down the left field line for a home run, and Casey Stengel, I think, might have heard me from the dugout, and he got a little annoyed at me doing that, but he loved Billy, so deep down in his heart, I don't think he minded me letting Billy know what was coming.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Now finish the story. Did you drill him the next time up?
Oh, no. I did. But it wasn't one that I was really trying to hit him.
Right.
I threw one behind his head. No, there's no chance of it going to hit him.
Now, you know, everybody knows about the Yogi-isms, but I read a quote, and I don't know if you said this or not, but I have seen it's attributed to you, about the spitter. About, well, you know.
No, I didn't. I tried to learn how to throw a spitter, but I didn't have much luck. I couldn't control it. And everybody thought I cheated. And
well, that's perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, it really helped when they thought I was cheating, but I really wasn't.
We tell Greg Maddux all the time, you know, my partner on the air thinks that he cheats, and I said it's the greatest thing a pitcher could have going for him out to the mound every day.
Oh, I watch him very closely. If he's cheating, he's doing a great job of hiding it.
Yeah, and again, let a couple of guys think that he's cheating. I would imagine life gets a little bit easier for a pitcher at that point.
The way he pitches, he doesn't really, you know, he's got such great control and change of speeds. He's just a great pitcher.
You're still a big baseball fan, I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I follow the Yankees. I follow baseball very closely.
Do you enjoy your time in spring training working with the Yankees and going around camp?
Yeah, I went for, you know, this year I only went for 10 days over mm-hmm. to Tampa, but I enjoyed every day of it. Yogi came this year, and it was fun, you know, just seeing the young players and they'd ask you a few things. The older pitchers don't, you know, we don't even bother with, you know, what can you teach Clemens and Pettit and Messina and David Wells?
But is it
much you can teach
is it
guys.
Interesting to you, you know, Tom Glavin just met Sandy Koufax again this spring training, and he got such a kick out of that. And I'm assuming, are you aware of when a guy, even a major league player or a pitcher, just says, man, I was just talking to Whitey Ford, or I am talking
no.
to Whitey Ford?
I don't know. I don't get that impression when I'm with the Yankees. I mean, they're all great guys on the team, and they treat me nice. And you know, if they want to ask me something, they know they can come over and, you know, talk about it, or, you know, anything to do with pitching. I'm glad to, you know, help them if I can.
1974, you go into the Hall of Fame. How amazing was it? You went with Mickey, and I'd imagine as great an honor as it is, it probably got better because it was Mickey and you at the same time?
That was great. I was a little disappointed I didn't get in my first year, and I missed by not too many votes. But
did anybody ever explain, and I'm sorry, we'll continue with 74 in a second, but Joe DiMaggio didn't get in his first year. You didn't get in their first year. And is that just a Yankee backlash, or is there something?
I think so.
How is that possible?
I think two writers can vote from each town or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it works. It's about 400 votes, though. But I said, and I wasn't a guy that worried about my record. But, after I didn't get in, I looked at my record, and I looked at some of the records of guys in the Hall of Fame, and I said, geez, something's wrong here. But it worked out great because at the time, I wasn't thinking next year Mickey's eligible for it. And sure enough, we both got in the same year, which was just perfect for me, and I know Mickey loved it. So
236 and 106 with a 2.75 ERA. If that's not first ballot Hall of Fame, I've never seen first ballot Hall of Fame. You're the only Yankee pitcher, by the way, to have his number retired, correct?
So far, yeah, but I got a feeling we got some pitches it's going to happen to in the next 10 or 20 years.
How big a thrill was that for you?
Oh, that was so exciting. We were at at Chase Stadium that year we were playing, when the Yankee Stadium was being refurbished in the old-timers game in 1974, everybody knew I was going to go into the Hall of Fame, and the Yankees retired my number, and that was quite a thrill.
Can I ask in a strange way? I know the Hall of Fame is bigger, more grandiose, but to be a Yankee and to have that honor come about, is it comparable to the Hall of Fame itself?
Yeah. The Hall of Fame, that's just something you don't even think you're ever going to, make. But when we got in, I was so excited. I'd never been up there. I was nervous. I never was nervous pitching, but I was very nervous with my speech that day. And Mickey went out with my kids and his kids and sat up drinking beer all night. And he made the best speech I ever heard without even preparing for it, and I wrote my speech out, and it was terrible.
So you don't think you did well that day?
No, my speech was awful. I remembered to mention everybody in my family.
Right.
Cool Papa Bell, who got inducted with us, he introduced everybody in his family and forgot his wife, and we happened to ride back in a car with him from the ceremonies, and his wife was hollering at him for the whole trip.
Were you there with Bill Mazeroski last year?
Yes, I was.
What did you think of that moment? My wife even was moved, and it was the shortest speech in the history of the Hall of Fame induction.
I felt sorry. We all kind of knew it was going to happen. People told us, they said, I don't know if Maz is going to get through his speech or not. But, the people understood. He just was so tickled at what happened.
Well, you certainly know about one of the reasons he's in the Hall of Fame. Obviously, he's one of the greatest defensive second basemen ever.
Right.
But the home run in 1960, Yogi had maybe the best view of what happened at the end of that play. But obviously, being a part of that Yankee team, Mrs. Mantle told me Mickey cried all the way home after you guys lost that World Series.
It's the first time, first time I ever seen Mickey cry in a dressing room after the game. We were really upset. We outscored them like 50 to 30 or something like that.
I think it was actually bigger than that.
Maybe it was. And, we just, that ball took a bad hop and hit Tony Kubek in the throat.
Right.
And, that allowed them to score a couple, three or four more runs. And, they won the pennant in the National League and they beat us in the World Series. And that's all that counts.
Well, last thing for Whitey Ford, Mr. Ford, again, a great pleasure.
You didn't want to mention my book,
well,
did you?
That's what I actually want to talk about now, because you want to talk about a daunting task. I mean, you actually put together a book where you try to pick, or you do pick, the five greatest Yankees at each position. Now, a lot of people might say if you're a Brewers fan or an Angels fan, well, okay, that should be fairly easy. But this is the Yankees.
I know.
This was work.
We had written two books before, one called Mickey and Whitey, and then another one, Slick, about 12, 15 years ago. That was just a guy interviewing us and, asking us stories and all that. But this one, we really had to do a lot of work. We had to check on some old-time players that we weren't sure of, what kind of records they had. And
was there one selection that you were even surprised by at the end when the book was done that you even looked and said, boy, I didn't think I'd go that way?
I think probably, Tony Lazzari, we found what we did with him. Frank Grassetti was, who recently passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Frank, I called him and out in Stockton, California. We stayed very close friends even after he got out of baseball. And I just talked about and they made him tell me as much about Lazari as he could, and Joe Gordon, another second baseman. And Frank was a real big help, you know, with the book, especially with the older players.
And you worked with Phil Pepe on this one, correct?
Yeah, Pepe did a lot of research, too. And
it's a beautiful book, by the way.
It was fun. It's called Few and Chosen, which actually Phil came up with that title, and I kind of liked it. And it's a very good book. When I first met Phil Rizzuto after the book came out, I was a little nervous.
Uh-huh.
I picked Derek Jeter, and Phil gave me a big smile and a hug. He says, "You picked the right guy." He says that Derek's one of the best shortstops he's seen.
Is Phil Rizzuto one of the least talked about? He almost won two MVPs. I know he won one, but he almost won back-to-back MVPs, and that might be one of those. Well, how the heck could that happen with that Yankee team and what was going on in the late 40s and 50s?
I know, but when I joined the Yankees in 50, that's one of the years he was the MVP.
Right.
I mean, he was hitting good. I think he hit 10 or 15 home runs, which was very unusual for him. And stole bases and, knocked in runs. He just had a tremendous year, and plus he was a great shortstop.
And isn't it amazing? Because Pee Wee Reese and Phil Rizzuto were linked. The three center fielders in New York are linked. And then it was you, Don Newcomb, the guys who were pitching in New York. Even not being teammates, it seems that if you mention one name, somebody else will pop up.
Yeah. I really don't have an answer for that, but it does. You forget about a lot of the players from the past, and all of a sudden somebody will mention their name. Oh, boy, and then you'll remember something exciting that happened with that guy.
Well, think about it. I mean, you pitched against Warren Spahn, Sandy Koufax, Don Newcomb, all in World Series. You pitched against Ted Williams, obviously, a number of times. And the people that you played with, Joe DiMaggio to Mickey Mantle to Yogi Berra to Roger Maris. I mean, it is mind-boggling, is it not, when you think about the caliber of players that you were around and saw?
Oh, exactly. And, you didn't feel it at the time.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, all these guys are in the Hall of Fame with you years later. And probably the greatest thrill I've ever gotten recently was a few years ago. Ted Williams was on a Met game. They had a doubleheader, mm-hmm. and they had him up in the booth. And it was Tom Seaver and I think Fran Healy and Ralph Kiner. And they hit one of the, Seaver. Somebody said to him to Ted, "Who was the toughest pitcher you ever had to hit against?" And Ted says, "Whitey Ford and Hoyt Wilhelm," and I got such a kick out of hearing him say that. I know I had good luck against him, but he was one of the few. I just thought he was the greatest hitter of all time.
So that's about as thrilling, even that many years later, to hear it come out of his mouth.
Oh yeah, this was like in 1999 or 2000 that he said it.
And Willie Mays actually had a little fun with you, though, didn't he?
He did. He really did. Even games I won against the San Francisco Giants in a World Series, I'd look at an old scorebook or something. Will he get his 3-for-4 or 2-for-3? And we've had a lot of fun with that over the years.
Well, I will tell you, I have the book, and it's not only a nice, enjoyable read, but it's a pretty book. There are a lot of pictures, obviously, and a lot of things that make it a conversation piece besides the text. And last thing for you, I spoke to Mr. Rizzuto last year, and we spoke at length, much like this. And one of the things that we talked about at the very end is I'd asked him, and I find I enjoy asking players from your era, do you actually ever dream where you're young again, or you're pitching, or, you're nervous, you can't find your glove? I mean, do you have baseball-related dreams?
Not quite. I really don't. I just often when I see games now, I said, boy, I'd just like to pitch one more game and see, if these hitters are as good as they were, 40 years ago or something like that.
But you don't have those moments where you dream and you're young again, and it's a 55 World Series or a 56 World Series against the Dodgers? Or
no, I've gone over them, but, the ones that were played, I remember, a lot of different things that happened. But, no, it doesn't really affect me that way.
Did you retire at the right time? You talked about maybe wanting one more shot at today's guys, but when you retired,
no,
did you know?
I might have been a year late retiring, but I had a lot of physical problems with my arm. But the only thing, when I looked, Tommy John, I was with Tommy John last night out of Turner Stadium, in fact, and he reminded me, he says, the very last game you won in the big leagues was against me in Chicago. You beat me 2-0. And he says, about 2 weeks later, you retired from baseball, and I couldn't understand it. And I said, me either, Tom. He said, I think my record was like 2-4, but my earned run average was like 150 or 170.
Now, did you have Sandy Koufax type trouble? And when I say that, just the arm just wasn't going to let you go anymore?
Well, I had a lot of circulation problems earlier, which were corrected. And then all of a sudden now I'm 38, 39 years old, and my elbow kicks up. And I said, well, I'm not about to start getting my elbow operated on.
And the Yankees weren't very good then.
I wasn't making much money. I mean, I was the highest paid player and pitcher on the Yankees. I was making $78,000, and it probably was one of the highest in the early 60s. I think I was probably the highest paid pitcher in the American League anyhow. And I said, I'm not saving any money. I said, I'm not going to be able to retire, so I might as well get out of baseball and get a job and take care of the family.
You did coach a little bit, though.
Just that, yeah, 1 year. Yeah. I went back and coached first, and
not enjoyable?
I really didn't enjoy it very
much. Mickey said the same thing, didn't he? It wasn't really what he'd hoped it would be?
No. I just didn't like the road trips,
right. And
I wasn't involved in the games except coaching first. And, you know, first base coach, you don't have to be, not taking away from any other coaches, but, you know, just say, don't get picked off
right. Or
something like that.
Yeah, watch his move.
Exciting.
Get a good look.
Yeah. And then later on, I went back. Steinbrenner asked me to come back
right. In
74 to be the pitching coach.
Yep.
So I did that for a year and a half, and then I got out of it.
Last thing, Mr. Ford, you know, when you were done, right after you, you know, obviously the last couple of years, the Yankees were not a very good baseball team. How disheartening is that? You know, it's you and Mickey, and you guys are still there, 66, 67, and
yeah. You
could see it's not necessarily going to be what it was. When you had so much success, is it really tougher to go to the ballpark when things aren't going as well?
It was, yes, and I could see the team starting to go down the Roger, you know, wanted to leave the club. He
right. Went
to St. Louis, Roger Maris, and then Elson Howard was starting to not do too well,
mm-hmm.
And he got traded to Boston, and I could see Mickey slowing down, and I know Mickey wished he had quit a year too early
right.
than he did, and I felt the same way. I think I may have stayed around maybe 1 year too much, but it was tough. Just to see the team start slowing down, ending up in, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh
right. Place.
It was no fun at all.
Well, it's just not the place the Yankees were supposed to be.
Not at all.
Yeah. Last thing, and again, one other thing I talked about with Mr. Rizzuto is he had said the thing that he misses the most as he's gotten a little bit older is something will happen. He'll see a game or he'll be watching TV and he'll see an old clip and he'll notice that maybe people in the clip have passed away. And he had said, you know, the ability to pick up a phone and just call Mickey or to just call Billy or to just call somebody, it's not there. And he said that's maybe as sad as anything.
I know. And Phil unfortunately lost a lot of close friends. George Sternweiss was one of his best friends on the team. Got killed on a train, you know, going back to Jersey. It just seems even an older man like Frank Crosetti, we
right. Lost
him a few months ago. You know, I felt bad, but it's a shame. And then, you know, losing Mickey and Billy was just terrible at the time. And it still is. I still miss them both very much.
But you're doing well, I understand.
Yeah, I had a scare a few
yep. Years
ago, and I didn't think I was going to be around much longer. But I had some great doctors back in New York, and I'm feeling wonderful now.
Well, good for you. Congratulations on all that. I know you're in Atlanta right now, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay. And
okay.
I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I thoroughly enjoyed the autobiography and spending this time with you. And my dad has said it. This is a Dodger fan, by the way, sir. Willie Mays was the best player you ever saw. Mickey Mantle could have been the best player if not for the injuries.
Right.
And he saw Sandy Koufax in his day, but he said over a longer period of time, Whitey Ford was one of those guys that as a fan, even as a Brooklyn fan, you'd say, oh, yeah, I'd give him the baseball to try to win that game for me.
That's very nice.
And that's pretty big coming from a Dodger fan.
Well, that's great. I love to hear those things.
Well, Mr. Ford, again, I appreciate your time. Enjoy your stay here in town, and we look forward to maybe catching up with you again somewhere down the road.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
All right, you too.
Thank you.
A native New Yorker, he's been a Yankee hero for many years. In 5 pitching categories, he leads all Yankee pitchers. He still wears the pinstripes as a spring training coach. Let's meet and greet an all-time Yankee great, a member of the Hall of Fame, Ed Whitey Ford.
I was a Yankee fan, I guess, since I was 5 or 6 years old. And when I was 21 years old, I'd be playing with DiMaggio and Barrett against guys like Stan Musial, Roy Campanella. It's just something I can't fathom. It's just been great.
And it's hard to keep Reggie quiet too long. 5 minutes later, he says, Whitey, could I have hit you?
so I don't answer. What's the reaction? You don't think I could have hit you? I says, Reggie, let me tell you something. Ted Williams hit 215 off me lifetime. What the hell chance would you make? Reggie shut up for 30 minutes.
People's always asking me about Casey. He said, you know, what you always read about Stingalese, you know, people couldn't understand him or anything, you know. I never will forget this one time. We'd lost about four straight games or something, and he called a clubhouse meeting. He looked right at me and Billy and White, and he said, and I'll tell you something else. Some of you guys are getting whiskey slick. Nobody had ever heard that expression before, but everybody knows who he's talking to, you know. From the time that Casey had that clubhouse meeting and said, called us whiskey, that we was getting whiskey slick, everybody started calling me and Whitey both slick. And we've called each other slick ever since then.
I did it my way. For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not to say the things he truly feels, and not the words of one who kneels. The record shows I took the blows and did it my way. Yes, it was my